I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC, 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. Democracy Now!
We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the they're doing.
F-bombs and real bombs. Just hours after a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Iran begins, President Trump criticizes both countries, explicitly saying he's not happy with Israel. We'll speak with Iranian-American analyst Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Then what's the role of Congress in starting U.S. wars?
They were notified after the planes were safely out. Well, we complied with the notification requirements of the War Powers Act.
They were notified.
They were immediately thereafter.
As Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth defends the U.S. bombing of Iran, we'll talk to California Congress member Ro Khanna about the War Powers Act and funding health care, not warfare. Then it's primary day here in New York. Will Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani beat former Governor Andrew Cuomo in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary?
In New York City, we have ranked choice voting. That means you can rank up to five candidates for mayor.
Brad and I are officially telling our supporters.
Rank me number one.
Rank Zohran number two.
Let's send Andrew Cuomo
back to the suburbs.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's lashed out at Israel after its defense minister ordered intense strikes on Tehran just hours after a fragile ceasefire appeared to take shape. Iranian media also recently reported two explosions were heard in Tehran. Iran denied accusations by Israel that it violated the U.S. and Qatar brokered truce. President Trump spoke earlier today after posting on social media for Israel to, quote, bring your pilots home now.
Israel, as soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I've never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel. We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the they're doing.
Trump first announced a ceasefire on social media Monday in the wake of an Iranian missile attack on the largest U.S. base in the Middle East in Qatar. Qatar condemned the strike as a, quote, flagrant violation of Qatar's sovereignty. This followed the U.S. dropping bombs on three Iranian nuclear facilities Sunday and 12 days of fighting between Israel and Iran after Israel launched an initial unprovoked attack. Reportedly, Iran told Qatar and the United States that it was dropping the bombs on Qatar. European countries have largely rallied behind the U.S. On Monday, NATO's chief asserted Trump's offensive strike did not violate international law. The International Atomic Energy Agency warned of likely very significant damage at Iran's Fordo nuclear enrichment site after the U.S. bombing. Israel also struck the site Monday. This comes as the Iranian parliament has taken steps to suspend cooperation with the IAEA, demanding the U.N. nuclear watchdog provide guarantees of professional conduct. On Monday, Iran vowed to defend itself against any ongoing Israeli and U.S. attacks.
The military aggression of the Zionist regime against the Islamic Republic of Iran has been carried out with coordination, collaboration, and support from the United States. It is truly incomprehensible how you can describe an act of aggression, a crime, and a blatant violation of the law as something as admirable.
We'll have the latest on Iran after headlines with Iranian-American analyst Trita Parsi. In Gaza, Israeli forces have killed 71 Palestinians since dawn today, including at least 50 people who are waiting to receive food and aid. Among the dead are at least 27 people killed in an Israeli strike on civilians waiting for food in central Gaza, an attack that also wounded dozens and turned a relief site into what one Palestinian official called an open field of death. Separately, the WAFA news agency reports another Palestinian child has died of malnutrition in Gaza. 3-year-old Hassan Barbak died earlier today after suffering kidney and liver damage amid soaring blood acid levels due to acute malnutrition. The boy's brother also previously died of hunger. Their family had urgently appealed to transfer the children abroad for treatment, but Israeli authorities denied their requests. Meanwhile, the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, warns Gaza is on the brink of a man-made drought, with children at risk of dying from thirst unless Israel ends its blockade. The UN warns just 40% of Gaza's water treatment facilities remain functional due to fuel shortages. The Danish shipping giant Maersk will divest from companies linked to Israel's illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank after a sustained pressure campaign by activists led by the Palestinian Youth Movement. In a statement, the group said, quote, "This sends a clear message. Compliance with international law and basic human rights is not optional. Doing business with Israel's illegal settlements is no longer viable," unquote. The group is calling for Maersk to next stop transporting F-35 fighter jet parts that are used by Israel's military. The British government's move to ban the direct action group Palestine Action under Britain's terrorism laws after activists breached the UK's largest Air Force base on Friday and damaged two military jets. Previous actions have included spray painting Trump's Scotland golf course and disruptions targeting the arms manufacturer Elbit Systems, which supplies Israel with weapons. Palestine Action members have been arrested and jailed for their protests. On Monday, police cracked down on protesters who'd gathered in London to decry the government's persecution of the group, arresting several people. Max Geller is a member of Palestine Action.
Palestine Action exposed not only a security liability at one of the Air Force bases, but indeed the RAF's continued role in this genocide on Palestine. Within 12 hours, the government decided to take the unprecedented step of banning a domestic protest movement.
In a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed President Trump to resume the hasty transfer of immigrants to third countries, lifting a lower court order that ruled immigrants have the right to challenge their removal. The case stems from the Trump administration's attempt last month to send 8 people, mostly from Latin American and Asian countries, to South Sudan. But their plane was diverted to a U.S. military base in Djibouti after a judge intervened. The court's 3 liberal justices issued a scathing dissent, accusing their right-wing colleagues of rewarding lawlessness. Justice Sonia Sotomayor warned the ruling puts, quote, thousands at risk of torture or death, unquote. As nationwide ICE raids rip through communities, activists are warning immigrants who are taken into federal custody are effectively being disappeared, with lawyers and relatives unable to locate detainees in public government records. Advocates in the Los Angeles area say they've received thousands of calls reporting missing people following ICE arrests, as officials reportedly fail to log people's information in the agency's detainee locator database. ICE has reportedly lost track of immigrants in its custody, as it also repeatedly transfers people from one ICE jail to another. In more news from Los Angeles, photojournalist Anthony Orendorf was released from jail without charge Monday following his arrest last week while documenting an ICE raid. In related news, a Marine Corps veteran is pleading for his wife's release from ICE detention after officers arrested her during a routine green card appointment in May. Adrian Cloutier's wife, Paula Cloutier, is being held at an ICE jail in Monroe, Louisiana, separated from her nearly 2-year-old child and 3-month-old baby, whom Paula was still breastfeeding when she was taken by ICE. Paola was brought to the U.S. from Mexico as a child by her mom to seek asylum. She'd begun the green card process in 2024 after she married Adrian, a U.S. citizen. Her husband is bringing the baby to her in jail so she can breastfeed the baby. In more immigration news, Florida's building an immigrant jail that officials have nicknamed Alligator Alcatraz, with plans to turn an isolated airfield in the Everglades into a mass detention tent camp. The facility will cost some $450 million a year to operate, with an option for Florida to request a partial federal reimbursement from FEMA. Florida's Attorney General and Trump ally, James Uthmeyer, has said the state won't invest much in security as this facility is surrounded by alligators and pythons. The U.S. Senate's confirmed Rodney Scott as head of Customs and Border Protection. This despite mounting accusations Scott attempted to cover up and obstruct the criminal investigation into the fatal beating of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas in 2010. Rojas, a Mexican father, was crossing the southern border in an attempt to return to San Diego, where he'd lived for a quarter of a century, to reunite with his wife and five children after being deported. He was stopped by border agents who brutally beat and tasered him while he was handcuffed until Rojas died of heart failure. His death was later ruled a homicide. This comes as CBP has awarded more than $309 million to a North Dakota-based company to build 27 more miles of border wall along Arizona's border with Mexico. Environmental groups and indigenous communities in the borderlands have long opposed further wall construction in the Sonoran Desert as they warn of ecological disasters, while activists say the barrier will continue to force migrants to cross through more remote and dangerous areas in the desert where thousands have died attempting to reach the United States. In Sudan, the World Health Organization says over 40 people were killed in a weekend attack on a hospital near the front line between the Sudanese army and the rival paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces. It's not clear who ordered the attack, which left five healthcare workers and six children among the dead. But at least one human rights group said a Sudanese army drone was responsible. Fighting between Sudan's rival military factions since April 2023 has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 12 million people displaced both internally and across borders. In Bolivia, at least six people have been killed and hundreds more injured amidst clashes between police and supporters of former President Evo Morales. Morales' backers have been blockading roads and highways across Bolivia since early June to protest Supreme Court ruling that barred Morales from seeking a fourth term in elections set for August 17th. The court cited Bolivia's two-term presidential limit. This comes as Morales faces an arrest warrant for statutory rape after prosecutors accused him of fathering a child with a 15-year-old girl in 2016. Morales's lawyers have called the charges politically motivated. Meanwhile, his supporters say they won't end their protests anytime soon.
Do you think that by capturing Evo or killing him, these people will lift the blockade? No, it will not be lifted because the majority of the population today feels represented by Evo.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul Monday said she'll authorize the construction of a new nuclear power plant to replace the Indian Point nuclear power station, which was permanently shut down in 2021 following decades of anti-nuclear protests. Hochul said several communities had offered to host the plant, but she's yet to make a decision. The family of Wynn Rosario, a 19-year-old Bangladeshi teen from Queens who was killed by police officers last year, has filed a lawsuit against two New York City police officers and the city of New York. In March 2024, Rosario called 911 asking for help during a mental health crisis, but two NYPD officers instead tasered Rosario and shot him at least four times within minutes of entering the family's home. Police body camera footage showed Rosario was standing on the other side of the kitchen when he was attacked as his mother desperately tried to shield him. The officers responsible were placed on desk duty after Rosario's killing and have faced no criminal charges. And New York City voters are braving record high temperatures today to cast ballots in the closely watched mayoral primary. On Monday, a final independent poll showed progressive New York State Assembly member Zohran Mamdani edging out the disgraced former governor Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic ranked choice voting election. If no candidate receives at least 50% of the initial vote, as predicted, New Yorkers aren't expected to have the final result until July 1st or later. We'll have more on the New York City race for mayor later in the broadcast, and we may be able to speak to Zohran Mamdani himself. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israel's defense minister has ordered intense strikes on Tehran just hours after President Trump announced a fragile ceasefire. Iran denied the accusations that it violated the U.S. and Qatar brokered truce. President Trump spoke to reporters on the White House lawn before leaving for the NATO summit in The Hague this morning. He expressed extreme frustration with both countries, but especially Israel.
Israel, as soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I've never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel. You know, when I say, okay, now you have 12 hours, you don't go out in the first hour and just drop everything you have on them. So I'm not happy with them. I'm not happy with Iran either. But I'm really unhappy if Israel's going out this morning because of one rocket that didn't land, that was shot, perhaps by mistake, that didn't land. I'm not happy about that. You know what? We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the they're doing. Do you understand that?
F-bombs and real bombs. President Trump also posted on social media, quote, Israel, do not drop those bombs. If you do, it is a major violation. Bring your pilots home now, unquote. President Trump first announced the ceasefire on social media Monday in the wake of an Iranian missile attack on the largest U.S. base in the Middle East in Qatar. Qatar condemned the strike as a, quote, flagrant violation of Qatar's sovereignty. Iran gave advance notice before the strike, and there were no injuries reported. This retaliatory strike followed the U.S. dropping bombs on three Iranian nuclear facilities Sunday and 12 days of fighting between Israel and Iran after Israel launched an initial unprovoked attack. For more, we're joined by Trita Parsi in Washington, D.C. He's the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and The Triumph of Diplomacy. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Trita. So much has happened in the last 2 weeks, but let's talk about the last hours. If you can talk about Israel's attack on Iran, Iran's retaliation, then U.S. dropping these bombs, the significance of this, and then supposedly a fragile ceasefire in effect.
I think Trump is discovering the very core of the problem, and I think we can see his frustration here. And the core of the problem at the end of the day is that Israel does not want peace. Israel wants to continue this war. Israel wants only unilateral ceasefires in which it is allowed to continue to bomb the countries in question. That's exactly what it has done in Gaza. That's what it has done in Lebanon. And he wanted the same thing here. And he wanted to make sure that the United States could not keep itself out of the war that Israel unnecessarily started. I think there's a part of Trump that he genuinely wants to get to a deal. I think the manner and the pathways to that he's choosing are the wrong ones. But I think he was genuine about getting the ceasefire, staying out of this. We have seen the revolt that has taken place in large parts of his own base. And now he's discovering that the Israelis at the end of the day wanted to drag him to this point in order to keep him in the war, not allowing him to get out of the war or not allowing a peace or a ceasefire to break out.
And Trina, I wanted to ask you, we've had the reports in the U.S. media that clearly that Iran warned the United States before launching its counterstrike on the U.S. base. But only there's been a report by Amwaj Media, which is an operation out of Qatar that covers Iran and Iraq and the Arabian Peninsula. And they claim that the United States warned Iran before the attacks on the nuclear facilities, and as a result, Iran was able to remove most of its enriched uranium, and that there were no casualties on the Iranian side in those attacks. Have you heard anything differently, or do you put much credence in this report?
I do strongly believe this report. Amwaj has proven itself to be one of the absolute top news sites in order to understand what is going on in Iran. And their sources have been completely impeccable. But I also think that this is actually in line with past patterns as well, in which both sides, every once in a while, when they want to do something, but they don't want it to be too escalatory, they don't want the situation to get out of control, have given each other direct or indirect warnings. In this case, clearly the Iranians telegraphed very clearly what they were going to do. The Qataris knew about it long beforehand. But it was also a way for the Iranians to do something that went beyond what they did after Qasem Soleimani was killed by Trump in 2020, in which they struck U.S. bases in Iraq. This time they struck it in a GCC country, making it quite different from what it was in 2020. But at the same time, it was nevertheless done in such a way that there would be no casualties, providing the U.S. with no reason to escalate further, rather give both themselves and the United States an exit ramp out of this, which Trump clearly took very quickly, moving towards a ceasefire that he had to impose on the Israelis. And we're seeing now how unhappy the Israelis are about that.
And you said that the current escalation is not about nuclear proliferation. What do you think is the motivation, especially for Israel?
Well, from the Israeli standpoint, for more than three decades now, this has not been about nuclear issue. It's been about domination in the region, a geopolitical rivalry that they have with Iran, a significant fear that they have that if the United States and Iran were to negotiate, if they were to strike a deal, reduce their tensions, Iran would end up not necessarily becoming a friend of the United States, but tensions between the U.S. and Iran would reduce significantly without it necessarily reducing Israeli-Iranian tensions, which then would leave the Israelis in a position of abandonment, as they call it, and they would face Iran without having this type of automatic support of the United States. This is long in the making. If the Israeli concern truly was non-proliferation, then they would have supported Obama's Iran deal, the JCPOA, because it did close off all patterns for Iran to build a nuclear weapon. But Israel's preference was and remains an Iran that may have a nuclear weapon, but that is isolated, is at conflict with the United States, whose economy is being crushed, than an Iran that does not have nuclear weapons, but has improved ties with the U.S., is trading with the rest of the world, is rehabilitated into the international community, and as a result, can challenge Israel's position in the region and its aim for military hegemony, even though it does not have nuclear weapons.
Trina, I wanted to get your comment on Vice President J.D. Vance. He appeared on Fox News yesterday to tout the long-term effectiveness of U.S. airstrikes on Iran.
Our hope is that the lesson that the Iranians have learned here is, look, we can fly a bunker buster bomb from Missouri to Iran completely undetected without landing once on the ground, and we can destroy whatever nuclear capacity you build up. I think that lesson is what's going to teach them not to rebuild their nuclear capacity.
So that was the vice president. And if you could elaborate further on why you're arguing this U.S. attack on Iran has destabilized the world to, as you say, nuclear countries, nuclear bomb capable, you know, countries, both the United States and Israel attacking a non-nuclear country, Iran, what it says to other non-nuclear countries around the world, who gets attacked and who doesn't.
I think the vice president point is not one that needed to be made. I don't think the Iranians under any circumstance were under the illusion that the United States did not have the capability of bombing that facility. Whether the U.S. has the capability of truly destroying it or not remains to be seen, because we still have not gotten the final report of what type of damage was done here. I fear that the conclusion the Iranians will draw, which goes to your second point, is, and not just Iran, many other countries as well, is that you had here two nuclear-equipped countries attacking a non-nuclear state in the midst of negotiations, despite the fact that none of the nuclear-equipped countries had been attacked by a non-nuclear state. Israel was not attacked by Iran. Israel initiated this conflict. The United States certainly was not attacked by Iran. It initiated this round of attacks. There is no basis for claiming this to be self-defense, even anticipatory self-defense. What this then says to a lot of other countries, not just in the region, but throughout the world, is that you are completely unsafe vis-a-vis nuclear powers. And if you want to have some sort of an ability to deter nuclear powers from attacking you, you may have to become a nuclear power yourself. So I think this was a major blow to the non-proliferation treaty, similar to the manner in which many people in Washington argue that Russia's invasion, illegal invasion of Ukraine, was a blow to the non-proliferation treaty, since Ukraine actually hosted nuclear weapons before the breakup of the Soviet Union. So if that is the case in the Russian-Ukrainian case, it certainly is the case also in the Israeli-US-Iranian case. So I think that even though in the short run, some limitations may have been put, the Iranian program may have been delayed, I fear that this is going to dramatically motivate the Iranians to build a nuclear deterrence, and it will do so as well for other countries in the region, particularly Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and then, of course, beyond the region as well.
And Trudeau, what do you make of the reported divisions within the MAGA base over what is happening in Iran? Clearly, President Trump's scoffing at the Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, assessment that Iran was not building a nuclear weapon, and also Tucker Carlson and other key voices of the MAGA movement criticizing what's going on.
The whole movement towards some form of either confrontation with Iran, as we now have seen by the United States, but also the endorsement and the support that was provided by the United States to Israel's war of aggression on Iran, are things that I think has put a tremendous amount of strain within the MAGA movement and within the Republican Party. The only element of the Republican Party that's really genuinely has supported this is the more hawkish neoconservative base, which only has a base in Washington. There's no constituency for that outside of Washington. The rest of the United States much more falls into America First base of Trump support. And within that, you can see some very clear strains, because many of these individuals have truly adopted the view that the United States should stay out of these unnecessary wars, that the United States oftentimes is being dragged into these conflicts by some of its allies. And for some time, many of the folks on the right could manage to hold that view, but make an exception for Israel. But over the last year or so, I think it's become clear that that cognitive dissonance no longer was sustainable. Because if you make an exception for Israel, mindful of the fact that it is the country most likely to drag the U.S. into another war in the Middle East, at least, then you have kind of negated the principle as a whole. And I think we have seen that cognitive dissonance break down with individuals like Tucker Carlson and others going out long before this, really criticizing the role of Israel in terms of pushing the U.S. into wars. And now when this has happened, we see clearly how betrayed much of that base feels. Now, I think many of them, of course, want to get back into Trump's good graces, but not without making sure that the U.S. doesn't get dragged into this war. And I think part of the reason why Trump also was quite eager to get to a ceasefire, why he's so frustrated with what the Israelis are doing right now, is precisely because he's very much aware of the strain that all of this has caused within his own support base.
And Trita Parsi, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of diplomacy. Al Jazeera, by the way, is reporting Palestinian Authority has demanded a ceasefire deal announced in the Iran-Israel war be widened to include the ongoing conflict in Gaza. Next up, it's primary day here in New York. Will Democratic Socialist State Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani beat former Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York City's Democratic mayoral primary? Mamdani will join us from the campaign trail as people go out to vote today. Stay with us.
Black Spartacus heart attack machine. A Black Spartacus heart attack machine. I might throw a little money around, wondering who can be bought. Some might find they're cheaper and some stronger than they thought. Well, I'll stand a fall right here in my country, in my home. I used to think that I was alone. Well, I ain't alone no more. A Black Spartacus heart attack machine. A Black Spartacus heart attack machine. A Black Spartacus heart attack machine. Go!
Black Spartacus Heart Attack Machine by Tom Morello in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today, New York City Democrats are voting in an historic mayoral primary. For much of the race, the 67-year-old former governor, Andrew Cuomo, was seen as the clear frontrunner. Cuomo resigned 4 years ago over allegations he sexually harassed at least 11 women while in office. But polls show the race has become extremely tight. The possible new frontrunner, according to some polls, is a 33-year-old Democratic Socialist State Assembly member, Zohran Mamdani. He's risen to the top tier of a crowded field of 11 candidates in which voters will use a ranked choice voting system to choose five candidates in order of their preference. A coalition of progressive groups has called on voters to not rank Cuomo. Last October, Mamdani joined Democracy Now! As he launched his mayoral campaign and laid out the platform he's now known for. Today, he joins us on the phone from the campaign trail for a few minutes before we look broadly at this historic race. Zohran Mamdani, welcome back to Democracy Now! You held a news conference this morning in your home district of Astoria at sunrise?
Yes, I did, because that's the time that many New Yorkers are getting up to go to work. So they deserve a mayor who'll be ready just like they are.
And so talk about what your message is today and how you think it is that you have eaten into something like a 40% lead that the disgraced former governor Andrew Cuomo had. And now some polls are putting you ahead.
Well, Amy, it's the same message that we've had since we launched this campaign on October 23rd, 8 months ago. And it was such a pleasure to do so at Democracy Now! And sharing our vision for a city that New Yorkers can actually afford. Affordability is the crisis of the five boroughs across our city, where we live in the wealthiest city in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, and yet one in four New Yorkers are living in poverty. 500,000 children are going to sleep hungry every night, and the rest are in a permanent state of anxiety as to whether they can continue to afford to pay their rent, to pay their child care, to even afford the cost of groceries. And ultimately, what has powered our campaign's rise from 1% in the polls to being just a hair's breadth away from City Hall is this focus on an economic agenda that will deliver a New York City that working and middle class New Yorkers can actually afford.
And how have you been able to build such a large campaign apparatus, despite the fact that most of the, quote, establishment of Democratic operatives, the unions and the political leaders have not backed you?
You know, I think it's been incredible to see how the very New Yorkers who've been left behind by the politics of our city and of today have been the ones that are powering our campaign's rise. And I now speak to you with more than 50,000 volunteers. There was a point at the beginning of this race where there were some that doubted whether we would receive even 50,000 votes. And yet this campaign apparatus, of which I cannot think of a precedent in our city, is one that has now knocked on 1.5 million doors, made more than 500,000 phone calls, and ultimately is carrying a belief in politics that should require no translation, a politics that speaks directly to working and middle-class New Yorker struggles, and one that so often is being shared directly by one New Yorker to another at a doorstep or a subway platform or in a park, because too often we've allowed politics to become something where we wait for New Yorkers to come to us, or we lecture them instead of listen to them. And what we have done instead is reach out to New Yorkers wherever they are across these five boroughs.
And of course, this is the Democratic primary that we're dealing with today. And it looks like the general election in November will be a lot different as well, given the fact that even Andrew Cuomo, if he were not to prevail, is going to run as an independent, that the current mayor, Eric Adams, is also running as an independent. Do you see this as, if you prevail today, to be a guarantee of victory, or you have a lot more campaigning to do in the months ahead?
We got here by never taking any day for granted, and that's how we're going to run the rest of this race. And we're confident that we'll win the primary, and then we'll run the general in the same manner, just as hungry as New Yorkers are for a new city, a city that takes care of each and every person. And ultimately, I've been running against Eric Adams a second term from the beginning of this race, and Andrew Cuomo is running for that same term. It's the same corruption, the same donors, the same limited vision, funded by the very corporations that are benefiting from this inequality crisis in this city. And we are on the brink of defeating that second term in the primary, and we'll do it again in the general.
I wanted to ask you about the New York Times saying they weren't going to endorse anyone in this primary and then went after you. They said, "We do not believe Mr. Mamdani deserves a spot on New Yorkers' ballots. His experience is too thin. His agenda reads like a turbocharged version of Mr. de Blasio's dismaying mayoralty. As for Mr. Cuomo, we have serious objections to his ethics and conduct, even if he would be better for New York's future than Mr. Mamdani." They went after you about controlling rent. They went after you about grocery stores. Talk about what you have promised New Yorkers on all of these issues and why you think the Times is wrong. And do you actually think them going after you helps you?
You know, I think that their opinions are those of, you know, about a dozen New Yorkers, and they certainly have the right to it. And this is an election that will be decided by closer to a million New Yorkers. And ultimately, I was proud that when the New York Times assembled a panel of experts, they rated our campaign. It came to House of Life. And those are two of the issues at the forefront of most New Yorkers' minds in this election. And ultimately, our platform has been one laser focused on that economic agenda in our promises to freeze the rent for more than 2 million rent stabilized tenants, to make the slowest buses in the country fast and free, and to deliver universal childcare. Because ultimately, these are the ways in which city government can make life that little bit easier for each and every New Yorker, and finally own up to the tools that it already has, as opposed to pretend that it is merely a spectator in a suffocating cost of living crisis.
And finally, in about a minute that we have left, the last few mayoral Democratic primaries have been marked by very low participation level. What's your sense of the turnout for this election?
I can tell you just from the early voting numbers that it is very exciting to see so many more New Yorkers participate in this process. From the beginning of this race, we've said we wanted to bring more people into our politics such that our elections look more like the city that we love. And we're seeing so many New Yorkers, be they younger New Yorkers or New Yorkers who've lived here for decades but had never registered to vote, finally seeing themselves in our politics, in our policies. And ultimately, We know the importance of this is because the democracy is not just under attack from an authoritarian administration in Washington. It's also under attack from within in a withering belief in its relevance to the struggles of everyday people. And ultimately, this race is one way in which we can show that we can actually deliver a city that New Yorkers can afford, and we can do so by building a movement the city has never seen before.
Zoran Mamdani, want to thank you for being with us. We know you're on the road on this primary day here in New York. New York mayoral candidate and New York assembly member, Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. To talk more about the New York mayoral race, we're joined by John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, which is closely following New York City's mayor election. They had Zoran Mamdani on the cover of their January issue. John's recent piece is headlined, Zoran Mamdani's Path to Victory. Earlier this month, Mamdani and Brad Lander, the other leading progressive candidate in the race, announced they would cross-endorse each other using ranked choice voting.
We both know what we need to do to save our city from Andrew Cuomo.
You want to tell him?
You go first.
Nah, you go first.
Let's do it together. We're cross-endorsing.
In New York City, we have ranked choice voting. That means you can rank up to five candidates for mayor.
Brad and I are officially telling our supporters.
Rank me number one. Rank Zoran number two. Let's send Andrew Cuomo
back to the suburbs.
Now, this may be extremely strange for people who don't have ranked choice voting to have two adversaries endorsing each other. For more, we're joined by John Tarleton to lay it all out. Again, the editor-in-chief of The Independent. You just heard, before we talk about ranked choice voting,
yes,
and the significance of these two co-endorsing each other, what that means.
Yep.
Zoran Mamdani, it sort of reminds you years ago of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who the mainstream media hardly covered when she was running against Joe Crowley, longtime Democratic Congress member in the leadership of the House of Representatives. And she beat him. The Independent, your newspaper, had her on the cover before she even won. Do you see a replay here?
I do see a lot of similarities. You have a politician from an older generation like Andrew Cuomo that I think has really underestimated Zoran Mamdani in his campaign. Cuomo is comfortable with a very sort of stale, maybe outdated form of politicking. There's been almost no grassroots ground game from the Cuomo campaign. They thought they were going to win easily, so why go around knocking on doors? Meanwhile, Mamdani's campaign has now knocked on more than 1.5 million doors and had countless conversations with ordinary voters. And also, Zoran Mamdani's platform is really, I think, speaking to a lot of people who feel like government doesn't do nearly enough to make their lives easier. And that was something that AOC was doing 7 years ago as well. I think one difference is AOC was running in one congressional district that tended to have very low voter turnout. She won that primary with 16,000 votes, and Crowley got about 12,000. In this race, we're going to have roughly 900,000 to a million votes cast. So Zoran, ultimately, after all the ranked choice voting sorts out, will need probably 450,000 or more votes to win, and he's certainly has a very decent chance of doing that. So he's operating on, this is the biggest left sort of electoral undertaking since the Bernie presidential campaigns.
And John, I just wanted to ask you briefly about the role of the real estate industry, the landlords of New York. They're investing heavily in Andrew Cuomo, and Michael Bloomberg has tossed in money, several million dollars for Cuomo. What's your sense of why the landlords are so upset about the possibility of a Mamdani victory?
Yeah, the New York Apartment Association recently made a $2.5 million contribution to Cuomo's super PAC, which has received more than $20 million total from billionaires and major corporations. The reason the real estate industry is concerned about Zoran Mamdani, for starters, he's made freezing the rent a central part of his platform. Here in New York, we sort of have a patchwork of rent laws. I mean, going back to the 1940s, have their origins in World War II, but continue to this day, that provide what's called rent stabilization for about 950,000 apartment units, which covers about 2.4 million New Yorkers. And under the laws here, the mayor appoints all nine members of something called the Rent Guidelines Board. And that Rent Guidelines Board each year decides how much landlords, the maximum they can increase the rent on their tenants. Under Eric Adams, over the last 3 years, Rent Guidelines Board has cumulatively increased the rent by about 9%. Under Adams' predecessor, Bill de Blasio, in 3 out of the 8 years de Blasio was mayor, he froze the rent. And Zoran Mamdani has said he will appoint a rent guidelines board. All nine members, he will be the one appointing, that will enact a permanent rent freeze for as long as he's mayor. So that's certainly one reason the real estate industry is concerned about Zoran.
In a moment, we're going to speak to Ro Khanna, the congressmember from Silicon Valley, who refuses to take super PAC money. But if you can finally talk about that issue, we start at the beginning, just for 30 seconds before we go to Congressmember Khanna, and that is the issue of ranked choice voting. Even for New Yorkers, it's almost new, one previous election. What it means that Brad Lander and Zoran Mamdani have co-endorsed each other.
Yeah, so if the polls are anywhere near accurate, the results that come in tonight, Cuomo may be slightly ahead, and both candidates somewhere in the mid 30%, and the election will be decided when the ranked choice votes are tabulated next Tuesday, and Lander seems destined to finish in third place, and he's strongly, you know, cross-endorsed with Zoran Mamdani, and the polling projections that came out yesterday from Emerson, a leading independent pollster, which showed Zoran winning the election, they showed him winning it when at the final stage of ranked choice, when Brad Lander's votes would be reallocated. So that cross-endorsement could be decisive.
To hear our extended interview with John Tarleton, you can go to democracynow.org. John Tarleton is the editor-in-chief of The Independent. We thank you so much for being with us. Next up, what's the role of Congress in starting U.S. wars? We'll speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna. Stay with us.
Kele sagal jagata
Singh in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Just hours after a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Iran begins, President Trump criticized both countries this morning, explicitly saying he's not happy with Israel. This all comes 2 days after Trump ordered U.S. attacks on three Iranian nuclear sites without seeking congressional approval. We turn now to look at the role Congress plays in starting wars. For more on this question, we're joined by Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna, member of the House Armed Services Committee. Last week, he introduced a bipartisan Iran War Powers resolution with Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie in a bid to prevent U.S. involvement in the Iran-Israel conflict and reassert that any U.S. military action against Iran must be authorized by Congress. We want to start by asking Congressmember Khanna to respond to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in a press conference talking about the Trump administration fulfilling the notification requirements of the War Powers Act by notifying Congress immediately after.
They were notified after the planes were safely out. Well, we complied with the notification requirements of the War Powers Act.
After the attacks, they were notified.
They were immediately thereafter.
Well, for more, Congressmember Ro Khanna joins us from the Cannon Rotunda in D.C., deputy whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, member of the House Armed Services Committee. Last night, I watched an hour and a half Q&A that was a MoveOn.org event titled Fund Healthcare, Not Warfare. Ro Khanna was the main guest. Congressmember Khanna, respond to what Hegseth is saying and what you're demanding.
Well, he's just violating the Constitution. You can't, as the president, engage in strikes on a foreign country when there's no imminent threat without coming to Congress for authorization. In this case, the missile strikes were characterized as a war on Iran. That was how it was characterized in papers across our country. That's how the Iranian people felt it. And that's why Representative Massey and I introduced the bipartisan War Powers Resolution. Now, the good thing is, I think actually President Trump paid attention. He saw that there was a lot of revolt within his own MAGA base, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson speaking out. And he has gotten a ceasefire. Now the key is he going to make sure that the ceasefire holds? And is he actually going to engage in the kind of negotiation that President Obama engaged in to make sure that Iran doesn't develop a nuclear weapon? The danger is Iran is just going to learn the lesson of Pakistan and North Korea and take their nuclear program in a covert direction.
And Congressman, how do you react to some of your colleagues, your Republican colleagues, who say the Democrats are crying now, but when Democrats engaged in bombings without seeking congressional approval, they were silent, specifically for instance, some of the bombings that President Obama did in Yemen, the attacks on Libya and other countries?
Well, frankly, they're right. I mean, the Libya attacks were blatantly unconstitutional. Those strikes were also counterproductive. They incentivized countries to say, if you voluntarily agree to give up your nuclear program, the United States may still attack you. And the attacks on Yemen were unconstitutional. Bernie Sanders and I passed the first War Powers Resolution to stop the refueling of Saudi planes. So I have been consistent, as have a few of us, speaking out against unconstitutional strikes, whether they're Democratic or Republican presidents. The question for the Democratic Party is, are we going to take the mantle of being the anti-war party? That's not pacifism. That means against these wars of choice. The American people are desperate for that. The anti-war candidate has usually won, and Trump outflanked us in 2016 and 2024 on an anti-war platform. I am pushing my party to be very clear that we will stand against these overseas wars of choice.
And could you explain what the 1973 War Powers Resolution calls for?
Well, there are two different issues. One is the Constitution itself. And the Constitution says that before you strike another country and declare war, you need to come to Congress. The War Powers Resolution says that if there is hostility that the president has initiated, he needs to notify Congress, and then Congress can vote to stop that hostility. So it is a check that Congress has when the president acts in a way that defies congressional authorization. But what we should have in this country is not the need to use a War Powers Resolution. What we should have in this country is the president coming to Congress before they want to strike another country. And in many cases, they may actually get the authorization. Here, Donald Trump didn't want to come to Congress because he knew at least one-third of his own MAGA base was opposed to the strikes and would have debated and argued against it.
So you are co-sponsoring this resolution with the Republican Congressmember Massey. Trump aides have launched a new super PAC devoted to defeating Massey in his 2026 election. The new PAC, called Kentucky MAGA, will be run by two of Trump's top political lieutenants, his former co-campaign manager Chris LaCivita and longtime pollster Tony Fabrizio. Can you respond and also take this larger to the issue of super PACs that you have long taken on, rejecting super PAC money in your own campaign? And do you think the weapons industry are long profiting from these super PACs?
The biggest problem in American democracy is the role of big money. It has skewed our foreign policy into bloated defense budgets. It skewed our foreign policy in the Middle East. It has prevented us from getting Medicare for all. It has prevented us from taking on a big pharma and lowering prescription drug prices. It has prevented us from getting rid of fossil fuel subsidies. It is why I don't take any PAC money. It's why Summer Lee and I have a bill to outlaw super PACs that still would be constitutional under Citizens United. If you can regulate the amount of money someone can give to a candidate, why can't you regulate the amount of money someone can give to a super PAC? And what Donald Trump is doing to Thomas Massie is unconscionable. Thomas Massie is actually a profile in courage. I believe him speaking up in our War Powers Resolution helped put pressure on Donald Trump to not escalate this war further and to get a ceasefire. And the reason that Donald Trump is targeting Thomas Massie is not just vindictiveness. When he's vindictive, he'll tweet out. He may encourage a primary challenge. Here he's putting his entire apparatus, his top political operatives and a super PAC against Massie because he knew that other Republicans were thinking of joining that War Powers Resolution. He knew that he was bleeding his base and he wanted to send a clear message, a chilling effect to the Congress not to do what Massie did. Massie got under his skin, and I'm glad that some of the Republicans spoke out so we're not escalating the war. But it is just a perversion of democracy to see these super PACs. They took out my friend Jamal Bowman, and they threaten members of Congress in undemocratic ways.
And Congressman, I wanted to ask you, the all of this expanding hostilities in the Middle East come in the midst of Congress grappling with what to do about the so-called one big beautiful bill, the budget bill of the signature budget bill of the Trump administration. What's your sense of the impact of this continuing problems internationally on where this bill is going?
The bill is a betrayal of Trump to his base. I mean, Trump promised no more money on wars overseas, and I'm going to help support and fund the working and middle class. Instead, what is he doing? He's increasing the defense budget by $150 billion. He's spending billions of dollars on this war in Iran, and he's literally ripping health care, Medicaid, food assistance away from the working and middle class, many of them his voters. At the same time, he's giving a total handout to technology companies by banning states, all 50 states, from having any AI regulation for 10 years. This will mean no state could have regulations to protect truck drivers. It would mean no states could have regulations to protect workers against AI surveillance. No state could have regulations to protect kids against algorithmic addiction. It is a terrible bill. Tax breaks for the billionaires, handouts to corporations, huge defense increases, and hurting the working and middle class, ripping away their health care and their food assistance.
I want to play a voice from Gaza, Roe. Why not a ceasefire there? Al Jazeera is reporting that Palestinians are saying, if you're going to have a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, what about extending that to Gaza? This is a Palestinian man named Khalil Mosbeh speaking from Khan Yunis.
Whoever stopped the war between Iran and Israel is able to stop the war, which has been going on for almost 3 years in the Gaza Strip. Massacres every day, killing of children, killing the elderly, destruction of infrastructure, destruction of education, destruction of healthcare, destruction of everything we own in the Gaza Strip.
In fact, many say, Rokana, that Netanyahu launched this war on Iran to divert attention from the catastrophe that is Gaza right now. What about a ceasefire there? And how can you force that in Congress?
The report is heart-wrenching. Every time I hear about Gaza, about the over 55,000 killed, many women and children, the over 130,000 wounded, the 600,000 students who have not been able to go to school for years, the 400,000 starving, I think what a stain on the conscience, not just of our nation, but the world. It is why I voted against the offensive funding to Netanyahu almost 7 months ago. Now, look, I was encouraged that President Trump this morning finally said no to Netanyahu on a bombing in Iran. But he needs to say no to Netanyahu in continuing the bombing in Gaza. He has authorized $14 billion of sales and transfers since he has been president. He can simply say to Netanyahu, stop. And then we can convene the Palestinians, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Israel to have a solution in Palestine that does not involve Hamas, that involves the civil voices in Palestine, and finally have a Palestinian state. But the question is whether Trump is going to stand up to Netanyahu's bombing in Gaza, stand up really to Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are pushing Netanyahu to continue this, and I really hope that he will. And the